WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. There's very little in his new book about boys at risk, Angry Young Boys, that Aaron Kipnis hasn't experienced firsthand. Kipnis's mother gave him up to foster care when he was 4. He was first arrested when he was 11, and then spent the next 7 years living in juvenile detention centers or on the streets, trash picking and stealing to support himself. Kipnis eventually turned his life around with the help of a sympathetic parole officer. He's now a clinical psychologist, author, and consultant on male psychology. He's the author of Knights Without Armor and co-author of What Men and Women Really Want. In Angry Young Boys, Kipnis writes about social, economic, and cultural forces that lead boys to violence, including poverty, domestic abuse, and the brutality of our juvenile justice system, where many nonviolent youth offenders grow into hardened criminals. He also writes about his childhood experience as a ward of the state of California. I asked Aaron Kipnis what led his mother to first put him in foster care.
Well, like many teenage mothers, she didn't have adequate support, really. She didn't have the financial, emotional support, familial support, educational and economic opportunities needed to be able to adequately sustain caring for herself as well as a child. And after about a year of after divorcing my father, she just gave up.
What did you think then, back then? Why she had abandoned you?
Well, I think like most boys who are, or most children who are abandoned, you think you must have done something wrong. And so I grew up thinking for many, many years that I was a bad boy. I was somehow flawed because if I was a good boy, I wouldn't have been abandoned.
And your mom would pop back into your life and talk about maybe you coming home and then disappear again?
There was that kind of dynamic, and she remarried at some point to a man who turned out to be pretty abusive towards me. So that she tried to bring me back to the home then, but that's when I started running away and getting involved in the criminal justice system, trying to escape his violence.
So you ran away from home, from your stepfather, when you were 11. Mm-hmm. What was the incident that made you leave?
He beat me up. And I was little and he was big, and it scared me pretty bad, and I thought I should get out of there. So I ran away, and I wound up in Juvenile Hall in Los Angeles.
After a time in detention, they sent you back to your stepfather's house, your mother's house, and the beatings continued. Did you ever fight back?
Well, yeah, I went in and out of Juvenile Hall during that period, and by the time I was 14, I was really toughened up, because you have to be tough in the juvenile institutions. If you're not, then you're really at risk for being abused by the older boys in a variety of ways. So I found out, even though I was small, that if I was quick to react, that people would leave me alone. And if I acted a little crazy, all the better. So by the time I was 14, I felt quite confident and powerful in my fighting ability. So one day, my stepfather hit me, and I hit him back, and a major battle ensued. It was the first time I had ever stood up to him.
Did it work? Did it stop the beating?
Yeah, but it had to escalate to... he came after me with a pool cue. We had a pool table out in the garage that my mom won on a game show. And I had a hunting knife that I kept hidden out in the garage with some of my other little things, you know, cigar boxes full of bird wings and marbles and stuff like that. And I grabbed the knife and I said, "Okay, take your best shot, but if you miss, I'm going to kill you." And it was the one and only time in my entire life that I was resolutely prepared to kill another human being. And I think he saw that, even though I was just a kid. He could see it in my eyes that I was serious. I'd had enough. And he never hit me again after that. But I slept with that knife under the pillow for whatever months I remained in their household.
Now, you left home after a number of these incidents, and you spent some time on the street in Hollywood and Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco in the,
yes,
in the Tenderloin District. How did you support yourself as a homeless kid?
The way most homeless adolescents do. Petty thefts, rifling cars. Prostitution was the most consistent and best-paying activity. I always tried to get work, but, after you're on the street for a week, you're kind of scruffy. And it's hard to get legitimate employment. And people just generally don't want to hire teenagers who don't have an address or a telephone or any kind of references. So you just, the criminal element kind of takes you in under their wing and exploits you to whatever degree they can, and you do what you can to exploit them back. Later on in my, when I was 16, 17, I started selling drugs and got out of the prostitution, which was something that always made me pretty uncomfortable.
What did you charge as a kid?
Oh, I was cheap. I gave myself away, I missed my chance to, sell my innocence for a good price. Who knew that it really had any value? $10, $20 a time. $20 was would really make me happy. I mean, that could keep me in food for a week.
It seems like a lot of kids do drugs to just deal with the situation. Did you do drugs at the time to ease your conflict about it?
Everybody on the street does. They either drink or take drugs. It's painful to be homeless. It's painful to be outside the norm, the mainstream, and the way most homeless, not just kids but adults, deal with that pain, the physical discomfort, the emotional pain, the fear and anxiety of living in kind of a dangerous and tenuous life is generally to resort to some kind of way of numbing yourself. And drugs and alcohol can be very effective.
You attempted suicide a couple times as a kid while living on the streets. Did the prostitution precipitate that?
Yes. I've always been heterosexually oriented, but boys can't really make a living being heterosexual prostitutes in the way that girls can. Women aren't willing to pay for sex with boys in the same way that men are with young women. So you wind up working the gay trade, whether you're gay or straight. And it was emotionally confusing and troubling. And I think one of the things that contributed to my sense of despair, not the only thing, but and it's hard to recollect exactly what made me feel like I just couldn't go on, but I definitely made those attempts and wound up in at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute, a mental hospital, as a result.
It seems really ludicrous to ask or even to consider, but at any point during your street years, did you try to go to school?
I did. I hadn't been in school. Well, I did a little bit of the ninth grade before I started getting jammed up in the institutions. But when I was 16, I tried to go to Hollywood High. I just, I was longing for some kind of normal experience. I wanted to just spend part of my day with normal kids and doing normal things. And I still had it in the back of my mind that I could get a high school diploma. But it was really too difficult. School takes a lot of time, and when you're on the street, providing for just your own survival takes up a great deal of the day. So I just couldn't keep it up, and I dropped out.
When did things start to change in your life?
Well, I graduated from juvenile institutions to the California Youth Authority because I'd violated probation several times. And CYA was, youth authority is really a euphemism for prison for young people. And that was a more serious experience. It was frightening. It was challenging. The level of violence and confrontation and encounter with the other older, many of them gang-related kids, called for a whole new level of vigilance and toughness to survive in that environment. So I had a compassionate parole officer finally who came along and scratched his head and said, what are you doing in youth authority? You know, he looked at my record, said, this is ridiculous. You've never even been arrested for a crime. So he got me into a halfway house, which was run by the California Youth Authority. It was the first such facility they ever had, which was, I think there were six or eight of us living in a house in Los Angeles, downtown. And, you know, it was a non-abusive environment. There were house parents there, and there were meals on the table, and I had a clothing allowance, and I started working. I got a job working for L.A. County Schools, stamping numbers on teachers' checks, the same school system that wouldn't let me let me enter, because at 17, I was like, you know, the ninth grade was the last one I had even any credits for one semester. And when I was 19, my parole officer helped me get into a community college in Los Angeles, LACC. And I got a sense that this was going to be a much better road than criminal activity, which really, I mean, never paid very well for me, at least, and doesn't for most others that I could see. So I just kept pursuing an education, and I kept taking student loans, getting whatever grants I could. I kind of became a professional student and worked my way through the California university system, working part-time, coming in and out of school over the years, until I finally got my PhD in clinical psychology.
I'm talking with Aaron Kipnis. He's the president of the Fatherhood Coalition. He's a psychologist who specializes in gender issues and male psychology. His new book about violent boys is called Angry Young Men. We're going to take a break now, Aaron, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is psychologist Aaron Kipnis. He specializes in gender issues. His new book is Angry Young Men. Aaron, your story began with domestic abuse, and really everything seemed to follow from what happened at home and the chaos of a broken home. Does your research show that male child abuse go unnoticed because boys are less likely to admit it than the girls are?
Yeah, this is a very dicey topic because really, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we were really in denial about the sexual abuse of girls, and it took advocates for girls, advocates for women, feminists, the women's movement, to come out of denial and say, wait a second, this is really going on. This isn't just a fantasy. And so today we accept it. We know that there are, you know, a certain proportion number of girls that suffer abuse. But, you know, in our culture, we generally have this ideal or this ethos that boys should be toughened up. And a lot of boys buy into that, and so do their parents and teachers unconsciously to some degree. And moreover, because boys want to be seen as tough and not as victims, as you suggested, they're much less likely to report when they are physically or sexually abused. And a number of surveys bear this out.
So part of the problem is that boys don't get any attention until they commit a crime.
Right. One of the things we say in psychology is girls act in and boys act out. So, what that means is we often see that girls who have been abused internalize it. So they develop eating disorders or depression, or they're hurt themselves because they're not socialized so much to act out. But boys, when they're hurt and angry, tend to strike out against the environment that has allowed that to happen to them. And then they start getting some attention.
There's a lot of concern right now with violence in the schools in the wake of Columbine and other school shootings. And it's given rise to this zero tolerance policy, a trend towards zero tolerance for violence, aggression, drugs, and weapons. And it seems to me there's this a confusion or a contradiction in zero tolerance where it applies to boys. That on one hand, schools can foster boys' aggressiveness. There's this idea that boys will be boys and that a bruised face or a bloody nose isn't really taken seriously if it's a boy, that's just fighting as part of being a boy. But on the other hand, we have zero tolerance for aggression and for any of the accessories of aggression. Do you find this contradiction to be borne out too?
Yes. Moreover, zero tolerance is like a dragnet that is sweeping unprecedented numbers of boys out of the schools and into the juvenile justice system. Now boys are being suspended at the drop of a hat for smoking, for swearing, for acting out, for being boisterous, for kissing a girl on the cheek, like, you know, 5 and 6 year old boys, for smoking cigarettes, not to mention drugs, alcohol, weapons. And yet, you know, violence, most kids respect schools as sanctuaries. The violence in schools is nothing compared to the violence that adults perpetrate on kids. And here, for example, there are more children killed by adults every single week in America than children kill other children in schools in an entire year. We go in and say, just say no to sex. But our president can't just say no to sex. We say, just say no to drugs. But all around them, kids see adults who are abusing drugs, who are abusing alcohol in the movies, in the, on television, and in their neighborhoods, in their homes.
So if zero tolerance is a red herring, what's a better way of going about sex education, drug, anti-drug education?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that, because there are, and we've been talking a lot about the problems, but there are approaches that really work well in helping kids overcome some of these problems. This generation of adolescents is the smartest, best informed, hippest generation that's ever come along in America. I mean, through their exposure in the internet and the media, they're much more sophisticated in a lot of ways than we were in the generation behind us. This is, to some degree, a consumer generation, and what they want to be is astute consumers, and you can reach them that way. So instead of telling them, all these things are bad, don't do it, even though we do, to say, these things have varying degrees of harm. Let's investigate the potential harm for engaging in unsafe sex or premarital sex or using marijuana or speed or heroin or aspirin and go through the range of risks so that understanding that probably a third of the statistics bear out that a third of those kids are using and will continue to use drugs and alcohol throughout their school years. None of these massive expenditures on drug campaigns have done anything really to change the statistics. And what we call this approach is harm reduction, is to give them, to really educate them so that they can make intelligent choices to either abstain altogether, which we would like, or if they're going to indulge themselves in risky behaviors, to minimize the risk by being really informed about what is most dangerous, what is less dangerous. When we come in across the board and say, you know, all these things are, you know, from the road to hell, kids just tune out. When we tell them, we think you're mature enough to make a choice, but there's only one right choice you can make, they tune out. But they respond very well to being treated with respect and getting honest information, and that, I guess we would say, education over indoctrination.
I'm curious, you live in Santa Barbara. When you see kids hanging out around your house, not even gang kids, but just plain teenagers, boys, do you have that kind of fear that so many people have and that you're talking about really throughout this interview, that boys are dangerous and that
yes.
Teenagers are people to be afraid of?
Yes. Well, I think I share the concerns of most middle-class people. I'm 51 now. I'm an academic. I'm not a tough street kid anymore. I'm a little pudgy, and I have a wife. I have a daughter. They park their cars on the street. They walk through these neighborhoods. We live one block away from an area that has pretty high gang activity. People probably don't think about that in Santa Barbara, but actually we have 26 different gangs in the region. So when those boys come and they're hanging out with their boombox and the, hanging out on the corner, which they do sometimes, I feel a little apprehensive. But the one thing I have noticed is that if I just treat them like anybody else I would on the street, nod, say hello, hey, how you doing? Nice day, huh? Sunny, it's warm today. They tend to respond with a smile or, you know, kind of or a nod. Or recently I got so far behind on my just my work around the house after publishing this book, and I hired one of these boys to come and help me around the house for a couple of days. And we had such a great time together, and he was such a good worker. He helped me out so much. And when he left, I felt that I had made a kind of a link with his community. And now when I see them around, you know, and that one kid is with them, you know, I greet him by name. And I have no way of verifying this, but I believe that if some of those boys were thinking about doing some harm to me or my property, that that this kid would talk him out of it and say, no, hey, wait a second, that guy's cool. He, you know, he gave me work.
Aaron Kipnis's new book is Angry Young Men. He teaches clinical psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.